Zizek or Judith Butler.
It's all karma and sexy. Those are things that are coming back.
So a hot mic public proposal.
People underestimate Andrew Lloyd Webber just like they underestimate Katie Rose.
Welcome to Literary Connections. We're friends who started a podcast because we live on opposite sides of the world and we're using books to stay connected. I'm James Earle, both craving and distrusting positive comments on the internet.
And I'm Melissa Hansen, more Broadway than Britney.
Oh, is that from something?
No, it's a comparison for the book that we read.
Yeah, I know. It just sounded like it is a phrase that exists in the world.
It should be. I think, we'll talk about this, that I think that the actual protagonist of this book is not Britney Spears, but Ariana Grande. But we'll discuss.
Oh, okay. I think maybe I just don't know enough about Ariana Grande and too much about Britney Spears. Okay, so this month we are reading Once More with Feeling by Alyssa Sussman. And I want to just give everybody a quick spoiler alert because on this podcast we talk about the book as a whole. And so if spoilers are something that's important to you, maybe read the book first and then come back.
Mm-hmm. You'll probably be able to guess what happens by the first page, but it's still a fun ride.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, it's a YA and a romance book, and both these have predictable endings.
So tell us, what happens then, James? You've got 1 minute to tell us.
Oh, okay. You want to count me in?
Yeah, I will. Okay. And 5, 6, 7, 8.
Okay. Once More with Feeling has two timelines, and both are narrated by Kathleen Rosenberg, who is also known by her stage name, Katie Rose. She's basically a stand-in for Britney Spears, though you just told me it might be Ariana Grande. She's a celebrity that grew up in a child star pipeline and became a huge pop star, and then she fell out of favor. So the first timeline follows her rise to fame and subsequent cheating scandal that leads to her becoming a public villain. The scandal was that she cheated on some boy band guy named Ryan, who I thought was basically Justin Timberlake, but I guess I'm going to find out otherwise.
Yes.
She cheats on him with another one of his bandmates named Cal Kirby. So I was thinking about this as though, like, if Britney cheated on Justin with Joey Fatone, because he was the best dancer in the group, and that's what Cal Kirby is. The second timeline is Kathleen trying to make a comeback through musical theater, and the musical is called Riveted. And in this timeline, she has to work with Cal Kirby, and in the end, they revive the romance from their youth, and she's got a best friend named Harriet who slaps.
Woo! I love it.
Okay, I basically got it in 63 seconds.
Yeah. I mean, it's your 11 o'clock number was really compelling in that.
Yeah.
You really sold it. No, so to clarify my statement from before, I do think the inspiration for this is definitely, it's Britney and Justin, obviously, are Ryan and Katie.
Yeah.
I think what's interesting to me is I didn't realize that this book was going to be so musical theater, like, obsessed.
Yeah.
Which, while Britney Spears was on Broadway, she, like, left. She was like, I can't do this lifestyle. It's, like, not for me. She, like, left within months of her, like, being her that show with Natalie Portman.
Mm-hmm.
Versus, like, Ariana Grande has, like, a very similar sort of career as Britney, but she's returned multiple times to Broadway, and she features Broadway samples in the music that she writes.
I did not know this about Ariana Grande. I never knew that she was ever on Broadway, period.
Well, technically, she's never been on Broadway. She was off-Broadway.
Okay, but musical theater. She
yes.
is involved in musical theater.
Yeah.
I did not know this.
But anyways, I think we should go into the Britney Justin of it all first. I feel like that's, like, a good place to start.
Right, because it's the public villainy and the blaming of the female protagonist in this, like, celebrity story.
It is, but I think what was interesting to me, so obviously, like, the big turnaround with the Britney narrative is that we realized that Justin was a villain. Like, yes, Britney had made out with Wade Robson on the dance floor or whatever, and then broke Justin's heart, and then he did a whole, like, album about it.
Cry Me a River.
Yeah, Cry Me a River. Yeah. What goes around, comes all the way back around.
Yep. Comes around.
Yep. it's all karma and sexy. Those are things that are coming back. And so, like, obviously, like, that was the narrative we were all taught. That's why we hated Britney. I think what was interesting with Britney's memoir is we realized that Justin was a piece of shit the whole time. And, like, an active piece of shit, like, being like, I think that you should abort this baby. I think, like, I can cheat with anyone I want to from All Saints, and you can't say anything about it. There were just, like, a lot of, like, active assholery that Justin enacted onto Britney. And what was interesting is Ryan in this, he just kind of is a fame whore.
Right.
He, like, doesn't actually do anything that bad.
Yeah. I think that the world came around on Britney before the memoir.
Yeah.
Popular culture had a moment where it reflected on the way that, one, we sexualize women, teenage pop stars, and the way that we ask them questions and, like, vilify them in the like, expectations. This is a better way of putting it. The expectations that we have for them versus their male contemporaries. And then Britney wrote the memoir. But the point is the same. The dudes we are starting to recognize were active pieces of shit.
Oh, yeah. I mean, society is the real piece of shit.
Yeah.
Well, I think also Justin Timberlake, just, like, let's continue to malign him, is we realize that society let him, like, basically destroy the careers of both Britney and Janet Jackson.
Yeah.
He, like, is an active participant in the continued misogyny of society to his own benefit. And I think that was also part of, like, I thought that there was going to be a comeuppance for Ryan where he had a similar, like, Janet Jackson scenario where it's like, oh, he's a piece of shit. But he kind of just, like, he was like a nothing burger.
Yeah. Ryan was a nothing burger for the entire thing.
He had, like, no personality. Yeah. He wasn't, like, even smart enough to, like, write screw over a Janet Jackson, you know?
Right. It was one-dimensional fame whore, as you said.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what his interests are. I don't know. He likes singing, I guess.
But then he became an actor. He's like, he's just like, he's like a just normal fame whore. He doesn't like musical theater, so I don't trust him.
Yeah.
One thing, so should we discuss the book a little bit chronologically?
I wouldn't even know how to do that. The two timelines. So I feel like, you know, just to get this out of the way, the genre thing, the first timeline is, like, very YA.
Yes.
It's got a lot of YA problems.
They're at theater camp.
Like, who told on the person who gets kicked out. Yeah, it's a bunch of this kind of thing. And then the what is supposed to be modern day timeline where it's dealing with a bunch of 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds?
I think 40, early 40s.
Yeah, late 30s, early 40s or so. That one feels much more like a romance novel. Well, it is obviously much more of a romance novel. The sex scenes in YA are not as heavy as the sex scene is at the end of this one.
Yeah, I mean, also the way that the summer camp romance ends is that, like, they, like, kiss on the roof and then she runs back to her cabin.
Right.
It's very different. Right.
Yeah, and just the problems that they're having. So it's got these two different timelines. I guess we could take it all chronologically because it's always, like, first meeting, breakup. Both stories have the same trajectory.
They do. The first theme that I notice in the book, which is sort of chronological, is there's a constant inversion of power over and over and over again throughout the book, which I thought was really interesting.
Okay.
At the very beginning, she goes to summer camp. She's never been there before. Cal's been there multiple summers, and he's in the actual show.
Yeah.
And then his partner gets sick, and then so it just so happens that Kathleen gets to be in the show. And so Cal's the experienced one, but he's also always flat. Mm-hmm. But he helps her, like, impress the mean teacher with her dancing.
Yeah.
Then from that show, she is able to perform really well. She then gets the ability to audition for the sketch comedy Mickey Mouse Club production, mm-hmm. which that's where Ryan, who is already on the cast, sees Kathleen and is like, I want her on the cast. So then basically he gets her cast onto the show with him. And then she becomes the solo artist who then has the power. Mm-hmm. And then Ryan has to try to catch up with that by being in a boy band who opens for her. And then by the end of their time in their, like, 20s, she is actually now opening for Crush Zone after they had originally opened for her.
Mm-hmm.
And then same thing when we get to the adult life, like, she's like a has-been now, even though she was the biggest star in the world. And now Cal is in control because he is the director and the choreographer.
Yeah.
And so these constant inversions of power where it's like you're on the bottom and you're on the top and you're on the bottom and you're top and the competitiveness you have with the people who you are in the same world with. And then obviously there's the Rachel character who is the enemy from camp where then she like encounters her on Broadway again. And it's like, is she going to take over my role?
Right. And I think like that negotiation of power that is happening with the constant inversions, it is also gendered in that when Cal helps her when Ryan helps her get the role on Mickey Mouse Club. He then gets to tell the story of how he got her the role, and so it's him taking credit for her success. And that is a big part of this, is that the reverse is never true. Like, it's never true that she gets to claim Ryan's famous because of me, but he gets to tell the story about how she's famous because of him. And even though Cal Kirby is the choreographer and in charge and giving directions by the end of the novel, you get a sense that the negotiation of power has evened out a bit, that she is the star and he's the choreographer, and they both are really important parts of this artistic collaboration that's happening. And in that way, it's a lot like some other novels, like Normal People or Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, where in different situations, different people have power, and they both need to learn how to not be jerks about it. But in this one, it feels like she never really has the ability to be a jerk. Other people are always taking credit for her stuff.
Yeah. I think the only thing that's like different than that is in her relationship with Harriet, which is, of course, that makes a sense because it's both women.
Yeah.
It's not a bunch of men taking advantage of a woman over decades. It's like her relationship with her best friend, who is constantly like writing music for her so that she herself, the writer, Harriet, can become a success. Mm-hmm. And then Kathleen not allowing Harriet to have her breakout moment by not releasing the CD, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Just a side note. Was I the only one that was shipping Harriet with Cal Kirby for like half the novel until I found out that Harriet was gay?
No, I actually thought that Harriet was going to be hooking up with Rachel the whole time. Because she was being, both of them were being so secretive.
That's a good pair of the spares.
And then I was like, oh, that would be like the quote unquote ultimate betrayal. And then would also explain why Rachel was such a bitch at camp, because she was a closeted lesbian.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, this would have made so much more sense.
It would have been a good redemption arc. But yes. No, Rachel gets no redemption arc.
No, she just is just banging old dudes for money. Classic trope. Just women be womening. I thought she was going to show character development by being a lesbian. Didn't happen.
No. Just fame horror turned into money horror, I guess.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, so the Harriet and Kathleen relationship, I think, is like the interesting sort of thing, which is also, it's like on stage behind the scenes is another question of power, which I think Harriet and Kathleen have, with Harriet being a writer and Kathleen being a performer. And then obviously Cal choosing to then be a choreographer and a director versus being on stage. There is that question of where does the power really lie?
Yeah, and all of this happens on a foundation of artistic production. Like, it's all performance. It's all, like, making art and, like, collaborating with each other. And so negotiations of power within that are always fascinating because, I don't know, this is something that I've had a few conversations with about, like, whether or not true collaboration can ever exist. Like, people can have different skills that they bring to something and make something that's better than either of them can, but there's always somebody that's in charge that is, like, that has the vision for how it should be. And I think there are rare things where I've seen that this is not true. Like, have you seen that Beatles documentary by the Lord of the Rings director?
Peter Jackson.
Yeah, and you see, like, Paul and John working together. It does, like, one of them always is bringing the foundations of a song, but then from there, it does feel like a collaborative, like a meaningfully collaborative relationship. But also, as has been pointed out to me, this podcast is also a pretty good idea of a, like, we show up all together. We collaborate on it.
Yes, and I know that our producer always says she cuts the stuff out where we talk about her. But she is our Harriet and our Cal Kirby. We could not do it without her.
Yeah.
So who has the real power here?
Yeah, she could edit our voices to get us canceled in a second. There's a lot of power there.
Exactly. The one thing I'll say, though, is like, when you have the Beatles or something, they're just in that documentary, they're also just ignoring George Harrison.
Yeah, yeah, who is like the third greatest songwriter of his generation. And he's just, hey guys, I wrote a guitar riff. Is that cool?
And they're like, we're number one and number two, and so we don't have time for you.
Yeah.
And Ringo's just there. He's like, I'm going to be a train conductor on Thomas the Tank Engine soon. I'm here for the cash.
Yeah, and to make art. I feel like Ringo was also there for the art. He was on the side of art the entire time.
Oh, yes.
So I think that the idea of the public performance, though, and the artistic production that is meant for public consumption adds a lot of really interesting texture to the whole novel. In just a really basic example of this, obviously one of the big themes of this, it's said directly, is trying to forgive past versions of yourself, which is why we've got the split timeline and her trying to forgive a version of herself that existed two decades earlier. And that's much more difficult when it's done in public, like when your previous self lives larger in the world than you do. And that's like something that I think is unique to celebrity. But by exploring it through this, the theme holds true for everybody. Like everybody has to like think about how crappy they were and the bad decisions that they made in their past life and like find a way to forgive themselves. I hear people talk about like trying to find ways to love your past self. And I don't think that's possible.
I love versions of my past self.
Or at least not for me.
I think high school Melissa just really was like not realizing how much she was thriving, writing all of her weird Star Trek, Buffy the Vampire Slayer crossover fanfic. Yeah. I love that girl. Young James just didn't write enough fanfic. That's the problem.
No, that is the problem. No, I would be mortified if high school James was writing fanfic. I would not want to read that. That it 100%, it would be, if not incel fanfic, it would be like near there.
But with what characters?
I don't know. Yeah, probably Gatsby.
Oh yeah,
in high school me.
Yeah, on Long Island, exactly. So close to the city.
Like, okay, here's another way that I think that having her go through these issues of forgiving her past self and so on are interesting when we're dealing with fame and celebrity is that I saw this book as being in a trend that I'm seeing lately where celebrities are becoming self-aware that they're celebrities. This is going to sound superficial at first, I think, that they're becoming self-aware that they're celebrities. And what I mean by that is Madonna would change who Madonna was like every 5 years. Like she would do a revival. But there was always just like she's doing the performance of a character and it wasn't ever recognized as such. Whereas now, like Taylor Swift with Miss Americana and all these like the Eras Tour, like there's a, like she is making the performance self-aware. And it's not just her. It's, you know, I think that Beyonce was doing this with Lemonade well before, where it was like turning Lemonade into the story of her life and then performing that story in order to change the narrative around what was happening in her marriage. And I like it's done on purpose with intention and transparently, too. I think that's the difference is like Madonna was never like, now I'm going to go into my blank era. And like now it's like out in the open that celebrity is a performance of the self, that all of us are performing the self. Celebrities just do it at a scale that is unimaginable. And I think that this book was very much about that like the amount of times that she would say, you know, how she had to sing in a squeaky voice. And like, actually, I have a good voice and it is genuinely powerful. And so this recognition that, and I think this is the point, celebrities have to play a role to fit the zeitgeist of whatever they're in. And so, like, Taylor Swift will say this kind of thing specifically, she'll say, and then everybody said that I was, you know, trying to get attention, so I just dropped off the face of the planet for 2 years. And then people were saying, oh, she's dating too much, so I get into a really... And so she is, like, purposefully saying that her construction of her character is the result of her celebrity and, like, her the thing that she needs to perform at that moment in order to be palatable.
Yeah. And it's about being palatable. Part of that is encouraging parasocial relationships with the world.
Yes, right, exactly. Like being who the world needs you to be so that they can continue that parasocial relationship.
Mm-hmm. Versus like Madonna did not have really the same sort of relationship with her fans.
No. Yeah, nor Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
Right, and like they lived above it, but were still doing it. Like looking back at it, like Madonna was changing who she was to fit what the world needed her to be at that moment.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I was thinking a lot in reading this book is private versus public self, but also how do you have authentic relationships between those two? Because I think that's the big contrast between younger Katie Rose. Her relationship with Calvin is private, and they're just like musical theater nerds who go to museums together. and her public love of Ryan, he like proposes to her in front of like a giant concert of people.
Yeah, I do want to get your takes on the two public proposals that happen.
I hate public proposals. It's never good.
I know. But the second one that was accidentally public, where Katie Rose has the hot mic, Kathleen, I should say. Kathleen has the hot mic.
I feel like I always love a hot mic moment. That's a trope that I do love.
Yeah. What happens when two tropes you love come in conflict with each other? You hate the public proposal, but you love the hot mic. So a hot mic public proposal.
I know. It's okay, though, because it still feels private. A hot mic moment is still, it's intended to be private in the moment.
That's so good. I also love this as a transition to another thing I wanted to talk about. So, like, in these moments when two things that are both true come in conflict with each other, and, like, your brain just sort of needs to reconcile them and, like, let them go, I feel like that happened a few times in this book, and I think that it's fascinating. And it has something to do with what we were just talking about with public versus private self. So I think that this kind of relates to the way that I opened this podcast episode with both craving and distrusting compliments. And like both these things are true at the same time. There's a few moments like that I think are very similar to the way that Zizek or Judith Butler talks about like the insufficiency of language to understand the world and how that can help us break out of identity constructions that are always already present in the world. And like Kathleen needs that at the end. She needs to like recognize that there are things that are ineffable. Examples of this in the novel that I saw were Katie Rose's, or maybe she was Kathleen at this point in the novel, but when they're dancing with Miss Beagle, which we've already brought up at Camp Curtin, her opinion of Miss Beagle is that Miss Beagle's a legend. She's been there forever. She's taught all these good people. And so whatever her advice is, you have to accept. And Cal can come in and just be like, no, we don't. Like, abuse is not the only way to get good at this. But she has in her head that, like, you know, there is a box that she puts Miss Beagle in that is good teacher. If you follow this, then good things will happen to you. And like there are so many things in the world where we're just like told that they're true, and then evidence, you just like find evidence that they're true. And Cal's able to like disrupt that narrative for her and be like, no, we'll just change these couple steps, we'll make it easier, and then everything will be fine. And like that disrupts her story of celebrity. Like Miss Beagle for her was a celebrity, and Cal like is able to disrupt that and be like, there's other ways to think about it. And that breaks her out of a cycle, and then she's able to become a better version of herself, and like that results in her fame. And I feel like there's a bunch of examples of this throughout the novel of like somebody having a reputation or an identity being forced onto somebody, and then a recognition that they're actually bigger than the box we've put them in, and then they can self-actualize.
Yeah. I had like definitely like circled around this idea of like abuse. And also, like, how do you do your best work?
Yeah.
And of course, like, Cal, being, like, a straight white dude who's at theater camp, is able to disrupt this narrative. But, like, Kathleen, a woman from a marginalized community being Jewish, who's, like, being told to change her name, she's just, like, put into this, like, box of... She basically doesn't have any control whatsoever. And I think there is this theme of control that comes throughout the entire novel as well, where like the number one compliment Kathleen gives to Cal is like, he is always in control and she feels out of control, or like she needs to be controlled. And then what she has to realize is that she has her own self-control. There's not actually like, she doesn't need to be controlled by other people.
Yeah.
To your point, like if you feel like you need to be controlled by other people, you're never going to self-actualize.
And early Katie Rose definitely feels like she needs to be controlled by other people. When she does not get the solo, for example, and Rachel does get it, Harriet, because Harriet's awesome, says, well, at least we get to do whatever we want. Rachel has to be inside rehearsing all day. And Katie doesn't want that. Like, she wants to be subjugated. She wants her time to be time-bound and dictated. Like, she doesn't want to have the freedom to do whatever we want, as Harriet says. She wants to be told to be in rehearsal and be told to be Katie Rose and to be told to sing in a squeaky voice and all of this stuff. because, like, the freedom is terrifying or whatever. I don't know if that's the reason, but, like, there's something that she's afraid of. And then, you know, when she's in a private room. So this is what you were talking about, what I think, with the private versus public self and how to reconcile those two things, or, like, how to what the relationship between those two selves are. When she's in the karaoke room, in a private karaoke room, which I think was, like, really well done on this author to, like, make that distinction that this was not at a public karaoke place on tour or anything, but, like, a private room with only their friends. She then sings Memories and nobody even claps. Like, it disrupts the whole way that people behave in karaoke rooms. Nobody even claps. They just go, whoa, like, what was that? And I think that was really, that's a powerful scene because, one, she, you know, obviously she establishes herself as an actual good artist.
She's a good artist. Memory is a very hard song to sing. People underestimate Andrew Lloyd Webber just like they underestimate Katie Rose.
Yeah, it's an underestimation, and, like, that's a self-actualizing moment. She realizes that she is better than the box that she's been put in, and everybody around her realizes that she's better than the box she's been put in. Like, that's another ineffable moment. It, like, disrupted for everybody else. Like, they had Katie Rose in a box that is Katie Rose, that is teenage pop star, is silly, does these things, whatever, is good on stage, and then realize that there's another layer to it, and that, like, helps her break out of that box. It's also really nice that Cal asks her to sing that specific song when she's doing the off-Broadway audition. So what song were you singing when you were featured in the San Francisco Chronicle for your private karaoke?
I have no idea. Because we went there on a Tuesday night, so there was no one there other than us and the Chronicle.
Yeah.
And so we basically kept singing.
And the Chronicle is your public-facing, and the private room, I guess, is the pub. So this is an intersection between your public self and your private self.
Yes, yes. On your question about, like, this private versus public self, I'm starting to think about, like, everything we were saying before about, like, Madonna versus, like, Taylor and her eras and Beyonce with Lemonade. I'm wondering, like, what is worse, do you think? Is it worse for you to be in, like, they're talking about crush zone, and this is also obviously with the Backstreet Boys and the NSYNC, where it's like, you're the smart one, the prom king.
Right, exactly.
Like, you have a persona that you have to play, but you're very conscious, like, this is my private self versus my public self, because my public self is Cal State, my private self is musical theater dork. Now you have to play up this, like, relatability authenticity angle.
I know.
Where you're trying to, like, minimize any difference between your private and public self.
Right. Because Kathleen in this novel says, you know, when critics hated on her voice, she could let that bounce off of her because she was like, well, whatever, that's not actually my voice. So that's okay. Whereas now, yeah, it's like there needs to be that meaningful link, or at least the perception of that meaningful link between the public and private self. And so there is no, I mean, what is better? I don't know. I don't know what the normative value structure is that we would be that we would be applying to adjudicate what is better. Certainly, I think it would be easier for celebrities to be able to have critics attack some form of their art, and for them to be able to step away from it at a distance and say, yeah, okay, that's okay. That's, like, not really me. But yeah, I mean, Taylor Swift is really, like, the apotheosis of this, where with Miss Americana, where, like, you see her actively constructing her celebrity self, and that now is the new version of her celebrity, is that she is somebody who savvily constructs her own identity.
Yeah, all the stuff with, like, Ryan and Katie Rose in the book just felt so, like, Travis Taylor coded, where it's, like, this very, like, public representation of love. And my question is, like, how real can that be when your relationship is so public and it's so much part of your brand now? And I'm not saying that, like, her love with Joe Alwyn was pure. I, of course, prefer Joe Alwyn over any of her exes. But I think there was a thing where I'm just like, oh, was Katie Rose never actually able to, like, be with Ryan authentically? Because Ryan isn't an authentic person. Like, I actually don't think there was, like, a lot of artifice with Ryan. He just wasn't that deep. Like Travis Kelce. Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to speak on Travis Kelce. I don't know. Yeah, it's also fascinating what this book does in that it inspires this kind of conversation where, like, it almost forces a self-awareness that for us, Travis Kelce is a character.
Mm-hmm.
He's not a person. And in the same way that Katie Rose, like, we can talk about Katie Rose and her identity construction, but we do this same conversation with Taylor Swift, who is an actual real human being, like a flesh and blood human being in the world. But we discuss her as a character. And she knows that. Like, she knows she's a character. Just like Katie Rose knew that she was a character in this novel. Not in, like, a postmodern sense, in, like, a celebrity sense.
Not breaking the fourth wall sort of sense.
Not in a Deadpool sense.
Not Brechtian.
Yeah.
There's then an interesting contrast, which is, like, what they're doing is putting on a musical where it's, like, about having to embody a character. And she talks about, like, singing Memory at the camp beforehand, and she could sing the notes, but she didn't get it.
Yeah.
Like, it's about being an ugly former glamour cat. And now she gets it.
Yeah, yeah. Also, the name of the musical I thought was perfect.
Riveted.
Because it means the two things that we've actually been talking about here. It means, like, being drilled in place where you can't move from that position. And it also means, like, riveted to your seat, like, really entertained. And, like, both these things are what the novel's about. It's about being, you know, positioned and being stuck in that position. So being labeled the sporty one, the flirty one, or whatever. And being riveted to that, like, being nailed into that position, but also that position is so entertaining, and that is why you are stuck there.
There's a scene where she and Cal are, like, deconstructing her character, and it is, like, she's strong, is something that she says, and Cal's like, well, is that, like, her internal self or her external self? And she's like, it's both!
Like, yeah.
Like, to a certain extent, like, if you've been going through a lot of things, like, your shell becomes riveted over time, same way of, like, any sort of thing, if you apply enough pressure. So it is, like, this very interesting sort of theme that comes throughout.
Yeah, yeah. If you perform something for long enough, that it ends up being authentic.
Yeah.
But I think meaningfully, there are always going to be those gaps. You do a performance for long enough, it does end up becoming largely authentic. But there are always going to be those unexplainable things in between, the things that don't fit the box, that don't fit the category, that don't fit the performance. And that is where the, like, it's basically what Judith Butler calls gender trouble, that thing that doesn't make sense, that, like, exposes the problems with the categories themselves and the way that language is used to explain those categories. And that allows you to live, you know, as Harriet said, now we get to do whatever we want. We don't have to be in this space. We don't have to fit this category. We don't have to go to rehearsals. We can actually do whatever we want, which is a big theme in the novel. Like, that's what Cal Kirby says. Like, the point is that we're having fun. The point of performance is that you're having fun. And I love that. I love that whole idea, because with identity construction generally, like, I think that the goal is that you can step into something recreationally and have fun with it. Like, everybody has their identities that you can put on when you want them and you can shed when you don't. But not all identities are like that. Like, there are the ones that people are going to apply to you whether or not you want them to or not.
Right. There's the idea of, like, everything is drag.
Yeah, yeah. Everything is drag. And I wish everything were more like drag, because you can take off the drag when it's not fun and... There are some identities you can't just take off when they're not fun, because they're going to keep on going.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, my identity as a soccer bro or a Shakespeare nerd, like, when they're funny and they're fun for me to put on, I can put them on. And then when I don't want them, like, you don't need to know that. But, like, I can just walk away from it. But, like, the category of celebrity, the category of woman, the category of, you know, there's a lot of things that she couldn't shake off. And in those cases, the performance is not fun, and so the point isn't that. And Cal Kirby has the ability to recreationally enter all his identities, because he comes from, like, a lot of just, like, classically privileged identities, white male, etc. You know, hetero in band camp, like, these are these are privileged identities. And so, like, all his identities are sort of recreational, where he can, like, put them on, take them off, and it's fine. But for her, it wasn't the same. And that's, I think, your original point about the negotiation of power and why that negotiation always looked different when the men were able to exercise the power compared to when Katie is able to exercise her power.
Yeah. And I feel like sometimes, like, it feels like women make more outsized reactions because they are actually subjugated for so long. Like, when I think about Britney Spears and her like break, so much of it was like she was under control for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And you just like, again, like, what do you do under pressure?
Right.
Like Justin Timberlake was not having to like push up against, like he was like very complicit in like what was happening, and he still felt in control the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
Like Britney did not have control, and she was being like punished for a persona she didn't even create, really.
Yeah, and her shaving her head, and then in her memoir, yeah, she was like, because I didn't want to be the pretty object of desire anymore, and like, so I was going to do this to everybody's fantasy. And like that's obviously not an identity she felt she could recreationally enter or exit anymore. So she had to like do a, I don't want to call it a violence to herself, but like, it's almost like she conceptualized it as such.
No, but it's true. So the last thing is like about like Ariana Grande.
Oh yeah. Please tell me about.
So how familiar are you with like Ariana Grande's most recent scandal?
No, I'm going to need you to walk me through.
Okay.
I literally have zero. I got zero on this one.
Okay. So Ariana Grande, she had her start off Broadway in Jason Robert Brown musical 13. From there, she went to Nickelodeon where she had multiple TV shows. Then she became like an international pop star. So I feel like there's a lot of similarities to the Katie Rose character through Ariana Grande. Ariana really, really likes Broadway. She, like, has sampled Sound of Music in some of her songs. She is going to be in the Wicked musical. And most recently, she was married to, like, some random LA dude. And then she cheated on him with the guy who played SpongeBob in SpongeBob the musical.
Incredible. This is incredible. I don't know. Sometimes, you know, I read too many books and I miss the real stories.
Yeah, this is the real story. And there's something that's interesting about Ariana Grande and how musical theater is like so written in her genes and how that influences how she plays her scandals. Because I think that when you are a musical theater person, you're like, you lean into the drama more, because they talk about this in the book, but it's like, it's about being in a place where you feel so much, you have to burst into song. Like Britney enjoys singing, but I don't think that's something that she feels. That's not like a sensation she's trying to create with her music. She's like, I enjoy singing. I enjoy being a performer.
But yeah, the performer part is definitely what I got out of the memoir.
Yes. And so I just think it's very interesting because I think like Ariana was like with like a more traditional, like he's a handsome rich guy from LA. Like she was with her Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
And then she's like, what I actually need
is some weirdo.
Is some weirdo who understands my musical theater soul.
Yeah.
Which is Cal / SpongeBob.
Right.
There is something interesting about that where it's another way of like not necessarily like shaving your head, but it is like pushing away from like what is expected, and in choosing who your partner is, like what is your true self?
Yeah. And like, I'd certainly have an idea of the type of person that Ariana Grande would date, and it's not SpongeBob.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm complicit in this, like, putting her in a box and then her needing to fight against it.
To be fair, she's definitely the villain in this story where SpongeBob was married with a child.
Oh.
It's not great. But what I'm saying is like she leans into the drama. And I think she leans into like following the authenticity of what she feels like the emotion. That's like, that's her version of like, oh, it's inevitable. We have to burst into song. And I think there are moments of that in the book where Kathleen is like, talks about like how drawn she is to Cal.
Yeah.
Where it's like, this feels inevitable. This is what, when you have an outpouring of this amount of emotion, you either have to sing or fuck.
Yeah.
Or both.
Yeah.
And I think it's a musical theater thing. I don't think other people feel that way.
I'll take your word for it. I never did the musical theater. The one thing before we move into the IB question that I can't believe we haven't talked about yet is Hannah Montana.
Woo!
Well, just because, like, we've been saying public versus private, celebrity versus whatever, and, like, there is a work of art that just did that directly, and it is called Hannah Montana.
Yeah, best of both worlds.
So I do feel like there's something there.
Yeah.
I think it's also part of that larger trend of, like, recognizing that the celebrity is a performance, and the protecting of the private self was what Hannah Montana was about.
If you follow, though, Miley Cyrus's journey,
mm-hmm.
it is very much like she originally released her CDs under the Hannah Montana name.
Yeah.
It was not like, these are songs from the show. It's like, I'm pretending I'm Hannah Montana and I'm releasing albums. Then she, like, releases her first thing under Miley, which is very Disney produced. And then all this ends up leading to her album Can't Be Tamed, where she's like, I'm not a Disney girl anymore. I'm whatever I want to be.
She's a wrecking ball.
Exactly.
If I remember correctly.
Yes, she's a wrecking ball. Okay.
Yeah, literally tearing down the categories and walls that were constructed around her.
Like, there was, again, that choice to then, like, get rid of those two identities into, like, one authentic identity.
Yeah. I think that Miley is a good case study here because, you know, she worked to get that job as Hannah Montana. Like, yeah, she's a Nepo baby, okay, Billy Ray Cyrus. But, like, I know they shot the pilot without her as the lead. So she had to fight and, like, earn that position. So she, in the same way that Kathleen had to, like, want her own subordination sort of thing, like want to be put into this box and be told what to do and to like get this role. And then like to learn the vocabulary around protecting the private self through the lines that she's literally speaking in Hannah Montana and then to join them in the end. Oof, it's a rich text.
Rich text.
This is top of mind specifically because there was a very good video essay published on YouTube like this past week or 2 weeks ago. At the time of this recording, by a YouTuber named Alex Avila, who did a close read of Hannah Montana as a capitalist mode of identity construction.
Yeah. What is our IB question this month?
So, okay, I'm just going to throw one at you, unless you want to think about it first.
Nope, throw it.
Okay, just throw one at you. Authors are aware of the power of their works to shock the reader. Referring to a work that you've studied, explore some of the methods the author has employed to do this.
Yes.
So I'll tell you what I think is the most shocking moment, and I feel weird about it being shocking, is when we realize that Katie's, quote, first time was her talking about her first kiss.
Yes. Very sweet.
I feel like that was a moment of, like, a harassed reader kind of situation where I'm like, God, did I really, like, imagine two, like, 19-year-olds?
Younger. Way younger.
That's even worse. Yeah, that I, like, assumed this thing and then got slapped down.
What's interesting about that is it's, like, a reverse shock. And I think it is us making assumptions about who Katie Rose is based on her persona as, like, the tabloids called her not Katie Rose, but Titty Rose.
Yeah, right. And that we, as readers, were basically doing that same thing, being like, she lost her virginity at band camp or whatever. And then we realize our fault at the end of it. No, I think it was, like, really good. It was, like, it was shocking and really on theme. Were there any other shocking moments we could use to discuss this question?
I'm still mad that there wasn't a shocking moment about Harriet and Rachel hooking up.
Yeah. I guess the other one was, like, when Ryan proposed, that was shocking.
Yes.
And I think it was supposed to be shocking because it's a surprise for the narrator, who was an avatar for the reader at that point in the story. Even though, like, oh God, Katie Rose is so unlikable for the whole first, like, 75% of this.
Yeah.
I had a hard time forgiving her self, too. She was pretty, pretty rough to be around.
I think that's the thing, is she was far less empathetic than Brittany is.
Yeah.
Like, I think in many ways, there was an opportunity to show Katie Rose go through the machine much more than she actually did. Like, I think in Brittany's memoir, you really get a sense of, like, how much that, like, fucked up her relationships with everyone in her life and her relationship with herself. And I think this is a very surface level when it comes to, like, how it affected, like, Kathleen. Mm-hmm. Like, she's like, oh, I bought some properties, and so, you know, I've made good investments, so I've just been able to, like, hang out with my cats all day until my 40s. Yeah, I, like, emancipated from my parents, but who really cares?
Right.
There's no unpacking of any of that trauma. It's, like, the only trauma that she wants to unpack is that she never was able to, like, hook up with Cal.
Yeah.
Like, properly, and that she feels bad that she accepted a proposal, a public proposal from Ryan, when she was going to break up with him. It doesn't have the same stakes.
I mean, she does talk about how she took all this, like, public abuse for so long, and, like, that's also some drama she's working through. But yeah, like, that wasn't the machine doing it. That was, like, a public perception. It was, like, almost a failure of PR that she was lamenting, which the failure of PR is, like, the failure of PR to protect women, but still.
I think in both ways, her relationship with Cal was shocking, in that the thing that we were leading up to with them as teens was the kiss and then her running away, which is very sweet and, like, not something that you'd be like, oh, she's going to be hung up with this guy forever. It was like very, but it was very sweet. I actually didn't think that she was going to cheat on Ryan.
Yeah, that was also very shocking.
That was very shocking. And I guess in many ways, like, if you have been crushing on this guy since you kissed him on the roof and then ran away, like, as you as a fully grown adult 10 years later or something,
yeah.
If you guys, like, kiss, like, you're just going to, like, go all the way. Like, I guess that makes more sense. But I thought there was going to be more sympathy, or, like, I would understand Kathleen a little bit more when that moment happened. Like, it was going to be, like, just like Brittany. It's like, I kissed Wade, but also, like, Justin Timberlake was a misogynist who kept talking about my virginity on Howard Stern.
Yeah.
There wasn't that moment for Kathleen. It just seemed like Ryan sucks a little bit, but he's not lying about who he is.
Yeah.
And he wasn't even like that. He's like, we can have like a fake marriage. It's fine. Like, this is PR anyways.
Yeah. Like, but it'd be great for our careers.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess there is something interesting about Ryan's character in the like fame for the sake of fame. It wasn't fame so that.
Mm-hmm.
It was only fame.
Yeah.
And like those kinds of people are fascinating. Like I find them fascinating. The people that just go power for power, money for money.
Yeah.
Fame for fame. And it's never like it's just so disconnected, I think, from the way that I think about things. But I find it fascinating when I see it in somebody else where it's like, okay, but like so that you can like what are you looking for there? A sort of superficial answer is like freedom. But, like, that is not what Ryan's after. You know, you want financial success or whatever so that you can do whatever you want to do or that you can, I don't know, get, like, fame so that you can get the fancy dinner reservations. I don't know. But, like, it wasn't that. I don't know. There's something fascinating about somebody that's obsessed with the metric rather than any sort of creation.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting because the book has, like, right, the two fame whore characters in Ryan and Rachel.
Rachel, yeah.
Where there needs to be a motivation. What is your core desire in life that you can only get through other people that will heal your childhood trauma? Like, that is the question that we should be asking ourselves as we, like, encounter people in the world and characters.
Mm-hmm.
And Rachel had to change her name. Like, she had a stage name. Like, clearly there's, like, trauma to unpack there. It's like, her authentic self is not worthy of being famous.
Mm-hmm.
But we, like, never, like, unpack. Like, she's still, like, a bitch the whole time and sucks. And Ryan, we have no idea why he has such a hole in his heart that he needs to be famous. I guess I don't know what Justin Timberlake's childhood trauma is. I've really not cared to know. So maybe this is also a failure of me. I'm not giving Justin Timberlake a moment to understand his trauma.
Right. I wonder if Justin Timberlake is one of those people that's fame for the sake of fame. There are moments of nerdiness from Justin Timberlake where he like beatboxes or something where you're like, oh, he does like appreciate the art of music and the way things happen. And so I do get that sense from him. But yeah, I wonder to what degree he's just like he doesn't want to be famous so that he could make more music. I think there's a part of him that wants to be famous because he wants to be famous.
Yeah, I think he wants fame to be famous. I think he views himself as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And he wants people to respect his craft to a certain extent. And I think when you come up through the boy band, Disney,
people don't respect the craft, yeah.
No. It's the same thing as like singing in your weird nasal voice.
Yeah.
It's like him having to feel like he has to make up for the fact that people are what he feels like are underestimating him.
Yeah. Have we underestimated him? Are you saying that NSYNC is his childhood trauma?
Oh, no. I don't know. Ryan Gosling got out of Mickey Mouse Club, and now he's singing I'm Just Ken on the Oscar stage.
Yeah. No, I respect Ryan Gosling's craft.
Yeah.
In a way that I don't Justin Timberlake's.
Yeah, I think he wants to be Ryan Gosling.
That makes sense.
I think all of our trauma is that none of us are Ryan Gosling except Ryan Gosling.
And like Ryan Gosling or Ken's character arc in Barbie is also thematically appropriate to some of the things we've been talking about where he has to define himself based on whether or not he has Barbie's attention or not. And like this is where he gets his value from. And it's not until he realizes that like he can have interests on his own and like be something else and escape the box of Ken. Like obviously the line Ken is me is really interesting. It's not like I am Ken. It's Ken is me. And so like if Ken is a proxy for man, then man is me is a really powerful statement because he's saying that whatever I am that is what man is, not the other way around, where like there is the concept of man that I need to fit into, but man is what I do. Like, I perform man, so therefore man is subordinate to me rather than me be subordinate to the category position. And I think that's sort of what this book is about as well, is like Katie Rose is subordinate to Kathleen Rosenberg, and that Kathleen Rosenberg gets to perform and define what that stage name is, or what that like celebrity looks like. And I hope we can all do that. We've rolled really far away from the question.
We did, but I like us ending on that. I feel like that's a really like great encapsulation of our discussion today.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about what we're going to read next.
Yeah, I feel like we've been doing a lot of things that are contemporary and realistic. Maybe in 2024, things are having some ups and some downs. Maybe we need some escapism.
Mm. I've had a lot of fun with the realistic stuff, but we've not done fantasy in a long time.
Yes.
There's an author that's been on my radar for a very long time named Andrew Joseph White, and I've not read anything by Andrew Joseph White, but I've heard that this author has a new novel out, and it comes up in a lot of conversations where people say it changes the way that they think about YA literature or what the potentials of YA literature are. So would you be up for reading The Spirit Bears Its Teeth by Andrew Joseph White?
Very much so. I mean, London, 1883, death conquers all.
All right. Let's do that for next month.
Sounds great. Literary Connections is hosted by me, Melissa Hansen, and James Earl, and we're produced by Kimberly Johnson. If you've enjoyed our conversation, you can leave us a review on iTunes, or you can follow us on X at @lit_connections. Join us next month when we'll be reading The Spirit Bears Its Teeth by Andrew Joseph White.
See you next month.